afternoon. I'm calling to order the meeting of the Jefferson County Public Hospital District Number 2 Special Session on Wednesday, June 6, 2018. The purpose of this is to hear the independent auditor's report. We will receive the auditor's report from Mr. Tom Dingus of Dingus, Sacor and Associates, PLLC. The report will include a review of the 2017 financial statement audit and related financial statements, single audit report, and communication with those charged with governance. No action will be taken. We should conclude around 4:30 p.m. It is being recorded. Because it is a special meeting, there will be no public comment. However, any member of the public who wishes to comment can certainly do so after the meeting. At this time, I will turn the meeting over to Mr. Glenn, our CEO.
Here is Tom.
All right.
Well, I think I have been here just short of 8 years, so I think this is the seventh presentation that Tom has given, the seventh audit that he's performed for us over the years. So I think one benefit of that is we do get the history and the benefit of Tom knowing us really well, and so internal benchmark and observation, but also with all the different audits he does around the state, he's able to apply external benchmarks and observations. So I look forward to another informative presentation.
All right. Well, there was a name's Tom Dingus from Dingus Air Corps Associates, and I recognize everyone from the previous presentations. So I have a PowerPoint presentation, and then also I think everybody has a paper copy of the financial statements and the financial indicators in the letter. And I'll reference those copies as I go, but you can either follow along with the PowerPoint and not look at the reports, or look at the reports as you go along, or some hybrid of whatever makes you most comfortable. But first up, just a little bit of who we are. I think most of you know us. We're a CPA firm. We specialize in healthcare. Over 95% of what we do is healthcare. We serve around 75 critical access hospitals through the West. We work with over half the public hospital districts in the state of Washington, and over half the critical access hospitals in the state of Washington as well. And do an array of services for healthcare organizations. So that was the quick commercial. Agenda, go through the audited financial statements, and then the financial indicators with the ratios and comparison information, and then a short little letter at the end with the required communication of things you want to know from your auditor as the governing board. So first up, on starting with the audited financial statements, is on pages 1 and 2, is the first of three independent auditor's reports that are in the financial statements. You're always going to have two as a public hospital district, but as with the single audit, which I'll get to later, with the federal funding, with the USDA loan guarantees, you also have the third auditor's report this year as well, had last year. We might have that next year. Let's just get some money somewhere else. So the first one is the report on the financial statements, and it is an unmodified opinion, which means that the financial statements that follow present fairly the results of operations and the financial position of the organization. Hope it says what it does say. Pages 3 through 7 are management's discussion and analysis. It's prepared by management. Hillary writes it. Others, it's condensed financial statements and a narrative that goes with the financial statements. It's a good reference point to go back, essentially get the story of what happened during the year and the financial position of the organization. So if you refer back to the financial statements, it's probably the best places to go just to kind of get the condensed version there. Then kind of just going to hit the highlights of the audit and kind of some key numbers. And on page 8 is the asset part of the statement of financial position or balance sheet. And we'll come back to the cash numbers and the investment numbers and the patient accounts receivable when we get to the second report, the financial indicators. But kind of a key number here is the third one down, is the estimated third-party payer settlements. And you can see it's $6,378,000 receivable. Consists really of two major things. One is an estimate of $2.3 million receivable on the 2017 Medicare cost report. As your organization grew, expenses grew, building costs with the new building were essentially underpaid by Medicare for the year. So there's a $2.3 million receivable there. And then the other, about $4.1 million of that is related to the Rural Health Clinic Medicaid Managed Care Reconciliations for 2014 through 2017 for each of your rural health clinics. I don't think a lot was added to that this year. This year was, most of that receivable is not from 17, it's from 14, 15, and 16 of just some payment issues through those years. And so now it's a little closer. This goes away in 2018 because the payment system changed and now you're getting the enhancements matched up to the encounters as you go forward in 2018. So this starts to fade away as a settlement issue to work with. And just to give Bob's presentation to critical access hospitals and rural hospitals, there's so many revenue streams that are not directly tied to actually, you know, billing the patient and getting somebody to pay for it. There's the cost report settlements, there's incentive payments from a few years ago, all these, you know, things mixing into it, DISH payments, disproportionate share hospital payment, payments for some hospitals, and all the give and take of that that doesn't exactly tie into what you're doing at that any given moment. That's the main key number on this page. The next page, liabilities and net position. And probably just a couple things on this is the fifth or sixth line down, the electronic health records incentive payback of $276,000. Not a particularly big number, but that's good. And that this was when the state of Washington went through and audited or had an audit done, was required by the federal government to have an audit done of the Medicaid health records incentive payback payments they had made, and went back and kind of settled that up based on actual cost. Some hospitals owed, some got a little bit of money, and it all came out to 276, so not too big a deal there. And then long-term debt, just only about a $2 million net increase there as the interim financing from the building was converted into the final, and some of the last draws were also made in 2017 as well. So I think I hit the high points of the balance sheet. The operating results on page 10, you know, a lot going on here, as you guys obviously know, you see it every day and at every meeting. But 13% growth in the net patient service revenue from the prior year, you know, kind of going, patient days were up, surgeries were up, therapy services were up, emergency room visits were up. The rural health clinics and the primary care, probably kind of a net, a little bit down, but the specialty clinics, all up. Orthopedic surgery was twice as many visits as the previous year. And then the new women's clinic and the dermatology clinic and the cardiology clinics, all new services in 2017. So just a lot of growth. So all that and 13% increase in net patient service revenue. Then you get down to the operating expenses, which in total increased about 15% from the previous year. And that is so kind of jumping to the bottom. So your operating income was $4.4 million in the previous year, $2.5 million this year. So some of that growth. And salaries and wages up 17%. And us, you know, a lot of that was the orthopedic surgery, surgeons, women's clinic, dermatology clinic, cardiology clinic, as you added 10 more providers during the year, and then also a lot of other positions and all the different support services you have there. So a 17% increase there. The only other one that really stands, a couple that stand out a little bit, is just the professional fees up a little bit as you had a few more locum providers and ER contract went up a little bit. And then the depreciation and amortization up a little bit, about $400,000 from the previous year as the new building's in place. Of all the depreciation on that and all the equipment that you've purchased along with that. So still a nice solid. And when we get to the financial indicators, it's going to see what that operating income looks like in relation to the size of the organization, which is good.
Yes. So we have more providers and more expenses, although the insurance went down.
Oh, that's a good, your insurance went down as you, because negotiated that through the collaborative. That with that group purchasing thing, that was actually, we worked with quite a few of the collaborative hospitals. That's an amazing amount of reduction, actually. Mm-hmm. Especially when you guys grew at the same time, so it not only went down, it went down as you got bigger. But all the collaborative hospitals saved a good chunk of money doing that. And this is only half a year's savings too, isn't it?
No, it was almost the full, it was a weird start date, but it was...
I want to say it was only like 5 months. Because you had to buy the extender for 1 month between in between, I think.
Sure. all the collaborative members together saved almost $1 million in premium a year.
That's great.
Yeah, I guess it was the power of competition. Somebody wanted to be insuring all the
years. Yeah. Both buying kind of Costco model.
Yeah.
Something that we are challenged with as we external benchmark is our salary and wage number, particularly as a percentage of revenue, because we have a disproportionate number for a hospital our size of providers.
Right, yeah.
So it's, because the doctors are in that number, right?
Correct.
So we always look at that number and it seems a little bit high.
Right.
But then we thought, well, but we employ more providers for a $100 million operation than most do, so how do we
And you employ
account
specialists
for that?
Too.
Yeah.
I think when you just have to look at it when you guys do internal measurements is to separate the two pools of salaries and providers.
And revenue.
I know when we, from an audit perspective, we started doing that too because it was the same thing. It was hard to analyze because it was so lost in the numbers. It's like, you had an orthopedic, employed orthopedic surgeon when you did have one that throws those analysis. So I think that's, you just have to separate it. I think you do know you internally. You show provider FTEs and other FTEs?
Yeah, month to month, generally we're looking at non-provider FTEs on our charts.
Yeah, keeping those numbers separate, Then the non-operating part of page 10, not a lot of change here, just other than you'll see that interest expense is increasing as the no more of the interest expense is getting capitalized as part of the project. And the full amounts been borrowed, so that is there as well. And then your total, obviously your change in that position is your net income for the year of $2.6 million compared to about $4.5 million this year. What am I supposed to push?
Did it not work?
I swear I was pushing that button before.
Batteries died.
It can be a little finicky.
Now it's working again. Did you do something magical over there?
Yes.
Well, next up on pages, well, next up is if you're looking at the financial statements on pages 11 and 12 of the statement of cash flow, you want to skip through that and then move to the notes. We're going to start on page 13 and go through all the way to page 29. And just always a reminder that the notes see three purposes when you look back at the financial statements of who you are as an organization, your purpose, where you're at, how you're governed. And then in the summary of significant accounting policies of how different transactions and balances are reported and recognized. So good reading for understanding how financial statements work. And then details of different significant balances and transactions. With an audited financial statement serves a purpose obviously for management and you guys in your governing role, but it's also designed for people external to the organization, your bondholders, creditors, others, community. And so what somebody external to the organization would want to know. Maybe you got to stand there.
Maybe keep the door open.
Yeah, or keep the door. Yeah, it's just strong enough to. No, it works when the door's open.
Does it work when the door's open?
So, it exists.
So notes the financial statements. Kind of the key ones is, and this is a different one that I've had in the past, is the updated accounting pronouncements. Two things. It's on page, or on page 15, but two to particularly be aware of. The first one, going over the one that's going to affect you no matter what, and that's the new lease standard that will be effective in 2020, which sounds like a long time from now. No, I'll get used to that. The operating leases for equipment and buildings you have will become, in the short version of this, will become capital leases, so those assets will be recognized on your balance sheet. And those liabilities will become liabilities on your balance sheet. So there'll be more assets and liabilities on your book. It's less of an impact. It's interesting. I was thinking it was going to have a really big impact on you guys, but as you've leased less buildings and purchased those buildings, you have some of those big leases that could have really been big numbers of assets added on and liabilities added on. It kind of went away a little bit. But so all equipment will be those leases, if they're leased, will show up as assets and liabilities. So that's going to affect the way a balance sheet looks. It's not going to affect net income or the income statement a whole lot. it'll show up as interest expense and depreciation expense instead of lease expense, but the amounts will be almost exactly the same. But it will make some organizations look way more leveraged than they looked before. And that's the purpose of this change, is to be more transparent about these obligations that a lot of organizations have. And it's interesting looking at different hospitals. There are hospitals that lease next to nothing. And I know one that they claim they lease nothing, and they don't. They really do not lease anything, not even any piece of equipment. And other places have a philosophy of leasing almost all their equipment.
Yeah.
And so this will hit them more. And I think the ones that will really surprise are the ones that lease buildings, medical office buildings. And it gets a little trickier when you have when they have multiple lease renewals, because you're always having to assess how long. Equipment's easy. It's a 5-year lease usually, or 7-year lease, or 3-year lease. You know the terms. But for buildings, a lot of times it's 5 years with a 5-year renewal and a 5-year renewal. So you're always having to reevaluate, are we going to terminate it at the end of the 5 years, or are we going to renew it if it's obvious that you would keep it at least 10, you have to assume that's the lease term and that's the commitment you've made. But then you could change your mind the next year based on facts and circumstances. So there's going to be a lot of work in this. And I am emphasizing this a lot because most accounting changes we as the auditors can help you do, this one requires a lot of internal work. And so it's not anything, you know, the auditors can write it at the end of the day and fix real easily. And the second one, and you guys may have heard this from some of your peers, public hospital districts that have joined the PEB for their health insurance have to record what's called other post-employment retirement benefit, which is like into the millions of dollars and hundreds of thousands of dollars expense. All actuarially calculated, no cash outflows related to it, but I work with a public hospital district, the first one's got the actuarial report. They have 175 employees in the plan, and they had to put a $2.3 million liability on their books, and it took a $500,000 hit on the financial statements. Absolutely no cash, and with 60 days notice, you can leave the PEP and the liability goes away. But there's at least 13 or 14 of this of your peer public hospital districts is impact. And so I guess the feeling is that most of them will probably leave the PEP because it just, even though it has really no cash flow impact, it's a huge liability. And the liability is there because as soon as you join PEP, you are essentially added a benefit that your retirees can access subsidized health care through the PEP because it's subsidized. And by being in PEP, that's an automatic thing. So you've made that obligation at that point in time. So it's snuck up on a lot of people. Yeah. So otherwise, that's probably the most exciting thing. you're not on the hook for that one. Capital assets, note 6, page 20, just note there that it was $9 million of buildings and equipment placed into service in 2017, so a lot going on. And then note 7 on pages 22-24 have the terms and the future debt service on your debt obligations, which are mostly, you know, at this point, the USDA and key government finance, LTGO bonds and revenue bonds from the new hospitals. What was there before is converted into the final series of debt that you have. And then page 25, note 8, is the operating lease commitment schedule. And I think if you were to look at this a few years ago, those numbers were bigger. So it's kind of dropped down some as you have less building commitments. But that note will essentially go away in 2020. Those leases become assets and liabilities on the books as those obligations. It won't be exactly those numbers because that's just the cash flow of those years. You have to put the obligation on the book for, if you have a 5-year commitment to make the payment, it's a 5-year total payment with that present value and all that good accounting stuff.
Most of that's for lab equipment. Huge part of it. Of that $2 million, it's about $900,000 was for lab equipment.
It'll probably change some people's decisions on whether to lease or buy. I think in the real estate side, it will definitely change people's minds. And then on page 26, or actually the bottom of page 25, net patient service revenue. I always like to point out, you know, about 53% of your revenue was Medicare and about 15% was Medicaid. So 68%, those two primary government payers. Bridge is always the, but a lot of your commercial payers are probably kind of government payers because they're governments that are insuring their government employees. So the very government-driven system.
Did that figure include the non-operating budget?
Just the, that's just the percent of the net patient service revenue, which is the biggest chunk. And then, kind of moving on to page 30, pages 30 and 31 is the second of the three auditors' reports. This is the report in accordance with government auditing standards, where we report on internal controls over financial reporting and compliance. No material weaknesses or significant deficiencies reported, so no findings. So, I see he has SIP back there, so it's no findings.
We passed.
And then on pages 32 and 33 is the third of the three reports, which goes away next year, or in this year, 2018, you know, auditors over the past. Is a single audit report, which because of it's required when you have federal funding and the USDA loan guarantee counts as federal funding in the years that you actually have the expenditures related to the loan, and it's over $750,000 in federal funding that you have. No findings for that either, so good. That goes away for the loan. So once the USDA has the loan with you, they don't require it to be a single audit. There wouldn't be anything to test. Other than make the payments, which kind of take care of, they'll figure that out on their own if you want. So that's it on the audited financial statements. Any questions?
Bruce, do you have any questions? Bruce?
No, I don't have any questions. It's a great report.
Okay, great.
The second document you have is the financial indicators, and you can, they'll be up here as well. This is where we compare your actual financial results to some your actual history for the last 2 years, in some cases, and 5 years, 4 or 5 years in some other cases, and then some benchmarked numbers as well. The benchmarks are the median, so that's the halfway point of those benchmarks on the right, the all Washington hospitals, critical access hospitals in the far west, and then rural hospitals between $90 and $200 million, and then all hospitals between $70 and $100, $150 million, kind of how you compare those groups. Which are, both of those groups are the second tier up there is a lower tier. And those numbers are grimmer, so like some of those, the medians are negatives on some of the for-profits, I mean, the comparisons. So your total margin, you want to be in the, like the 3 to 6% range. So I mean, it's 2.6, so pretty close to the 3% range, and then 5% the previous year. So you're kind of in, it's positive, and it's in that close to the range you want to be in. That had the bump in the 2015 with those recognizing those rural health clinic settlements in that year. Now with that a little bit. There's that one. Operating margin, because you really don't have that much non-operating revenue in relationship to the size organization you are, you have $400,000 or $500,000 of tax revenue, but a $100 million operation, that's not going to skew these percentages much. So your operating margin goal is really about the same as your total margin goal as well.
That's something that we have been spending more time talking about at SLG, and I go out and talk with hospital administrator colleagues, that there's a concern about whether the external payer environment will allow for hospitals to make money off of the healthcare business. And we had a meeting with some Swedish execs, and they were being very progressive about finding their bottom line outside of just providing healthcare services. And so that has been on our mind, not that we're gonna, you know, open up restaurants or anything, but thinking about it, as it becomes more and more difficult to just make this work. And this slide really illuminated that for me. If you go back to the one before, nearly all of those, you know, all hospitals, 70 to 150, that was a 3% margin. So basically, a 3%, they lost 4.5% off operations, but yeah. They just through big endowments or through other forms of non-operating income make all that up. And I think going forward, if we are going to, because most of the needs in our community that are emerging will fall in that bucket of it costs 2x to provide and you get 1x reimbursement. So we're going to have to find other ways to subsidize these services.
That's the trend we're seeing. I think there's, when we get to one later on contractual adjustment percentage going up, and I think that's the one that, and it's interesting, those can't necessarily put a finger on the single cause of it, but it's like there's like just this trend of just less reimbursement for what you're doing.
Yeah,
it's like not dramatic increase, but it's just edging up a little bit. You know, as we worked through as auditors this year, there was like, the allowance calculation, what it should be, not necessarily a conversation about you, but there's almost a little bit of denial going on that it's just getting paid a little bit less. All things the same, systems running the same way, same services, it's just a little bit less payment. It feels, you know, there's certainly outliers, places that did really, really well. You know, sometimes the small hospitals, they can bounce all over the place with a few good wins or a few bad losses can jump them up and down. But it's kind of a general downward trend a little bit of that income that we're seeing this year. With that, would you throw out some outlier instances, good or bad? It was one of those years that did feel like it got easier, I guess, probably for you guys.
No.
A couple years ago, you told me the status quo was pretty good, you know, with the Medicaid expansion.
Yeah, 2015.
Yeah, that
worked for me.
That worked for you, yeah. Worked for everyone, yeah. Days cash on hand, besides the operating margin we just looked at, I think that's probably the other one that's the most significant. You know, what is all the 25 million dollars you had on hand at December 31st, what is that in relation to your organization? And it's 100 days of operating expenses. You know, as you become a $100 million operation, to get to 100 days, you need more money. Mm-hmm. 25 million sounds like a lot, but of course, depending on the size of the organization you are, it's not quite as much as you might first feel. But that's stayed around the same, and you finance some of your equipment purchases and stuff with cash. And, I also have those cost report receivables eventually that will come in. Those third-party settlements will help a little bit there, too. So, you said 90 days of operating reserves is what you want, so you are above that. And then after that, you want another 90 for capital, but I think on the flip side of that is that you have a new building and you replace the capital. You have the capital, so you're not like, saving up for that. You're always saving up for the next big thing, but you've accomplished a pretty big thing for the last couple of years.
Yeah, pretty much buying that. Jay's building was almost up to the nickel of things where we were the two practitioners.
Current ratio, just your current assets compared to your current liabilities, your cash, price of accounts receivable, carry accounts, your accounts payable, accrued payable, current maturities, long-term debt. Anything above 2-1 is fine, so nothing, no big changes or nothing to worry about there. Capital equipment expenditures, percentage of annual depreciation. A graph that attempts to show if you're replacing equipment at the same rate you're using it up. So anything above 100% means you purchased more equipment than you had equipment depreciation. And you want to look at it over the 5-year time frame. And you can see, I mean, some years it's going to be less and some years it's going to be more. And obviously 2016 was a little higher as you had this lot of project that you replaced that year. And this one's always hard to do with the scale. I mean, the way that is, it makes the 182 not look all that big. But I'll do others that have a whole bunch of 70s and 80s, and 182 would be the really high one. So, I mean, that kind of take that for what it's worth. It's a pretty rough measure. Long-term debt, capitalization, debt to equity. Obviously, it jumped up in 2016 as you borrowed for the new building, and it held about the same as you paid off some of the debt, and it also took out a little more in the last remaining bit in 2017 and then had some net income on the other side of the equation, so about 37%. That doesn't really mean anything sometimes in comparison to others because it just means it's relative to where you are as an organization with the relatively new facility going all the way through. That's not a very big number. Some places when they do a project as big as you did, they're going to get in the 70s or 80s. And I've went places that have 0 or 10%, but that means they're also in a building that's fallen down around them too. So there's got to take all the factors.
With our debt avoidance plan, how far do you see that going down every year? About 5 to 7%? Or will it be slower?
It'll pop up some next year with, actually it'll probably stay about the same next year because there'll be more debt added. No, it's taking both sides of that.
What the?
So I guess that'll hit in 2020.
The leases.
Oh,
that'll
got
hit both
it.
Sides.
So that won't change much. It really depends how well our years are. Because this is really a function of how are you growing your net assets at the same time as your debt.
Yeah.
So if our years are good, then this continues to go down because our net position, so our project equity, we keep going up. So.
Well, about 1/25th of the debt number will go down.
Yeah.
Right.
Because the USDA is charging more.
Yeah.
Right.
You almost make more ground on this number by how well you do on the equity side, how much income is, and how fast you're paying the debt down.
Right, because it's on the top. Both the top and the bottom have the debt in it. So the equity is really the only part of it.
Oh, got it, yep.
Yeah, that part makes more of, I mean, paying the debt down doesn't make a difference, and borrowing doesn't make a difference, but how well you do the bottom line is going to make the biggest difference.
Sure, right, got it.
15 in the good year, that looks way better.
Yeah.
Days in net patient accounts receivable, 43, you know, see anybody in the 40s is doing pretty good. Occasionally see something in the high 30s. But we also see 50s and 60s as well, but 40s is consistent in a good spot there. The gross days and patient accounts receivable, very similar numbers, and then also just the consistency there is good. Then you go back 5 years, and when you have system conversions, that's when numbers pop up. And here's what I mentioned earlier, contractual adjustments. You can see it's kind of creeping up a little bit. What Medicare, Medicaid, commercial payers are not paying up as a percent of your gross revenue. You know, certainly some of that is as you raise charges, it does kind of increase that because if you're getting cost-based, I'm sure you're going to get paid anymore, or fees there. It's a little creeping up there. Bad debt as a percent of net patient service revenue. We kind of see just right with the median of most of the comparison hospitals. Not a hospital with a lot of bad debt, not a hospital with very little either. The next one's a little more comparison. This is your percent of bad debt and charity compared to your gross revenue. And the charity care is patients that theoretically don't have the ability to pay through the application process. Bad debt is theoretically patients that do have the ability to pay, even though there's always probably some in that category that would qualify for charity if they applied. So 2%, 2.1%, 2.6% over the last 3 years, so not particularly big numbers those categories, and consistent. Interesting enough, most places where those numbers have kind of crept up a little bit. I would say if you go out 5 years, 5 or 6 years ago, it dropped with Medicaid expansion, Affordable Care Act, and then it kind of plateaued at a certain place. And we've seen a lot of places kind of went back up a percent this year. Yours didn't, but some places did. So there's also that creep in the system in some theory. The more people that have higher deductible plans, they have insurance, but they're self-insured essentially for a big chunk that they might not be able to pay.
Are you seeing the increase in bad debt or in charity care?
A little bit of both. Probably more bad debt than charity care, but both, they tend to go up kind of the same together.
Question.
Yes.
So how does, can you give a more specific idea of how this compares to other hospitals?
It's to the lower end, honestly, based on gross charges. But it's so interesting, it's so, even state to state is very different, but community to community is very different because the demographics of every community are very different. And we'll go to communities that, you know, have 1%, and I'll go to communities that were almost 20%. Granted, the 20% are in like Texas where they didn't expand Medicaid. Don't hardly cover anything in Medicaid. And so that's the extreme. But even in the state of Washington, you'll go from some smaller farm communities that are only like 1%, and then other places that are more like 10 or 12%. So There's a range, but that's not a big number compared to most hospitals. So it's towards the low range. Full-time equivalents, talked about that with the adding of providers and other people as you grew this year with the 17% growth. And then the average, it's kind of fascinating how close the average salary actually stayed with the growth, because you threw in some pretty big providers in there, but you also added a lot of other people as well in the state. I think that was kind of actually fascinating how close that all averaged itself right back out. But I think, as Mike said earlier, the numbers are big enough that you got to kind of look at them in different buckets and you're analyzing them. This throws everybody together. Lowest paid employee to your highest paid employee. Net patient service revenue per FTE, really broad measure of productivity based on your employed FTEs. And so it did go down just a little bit as you had more growth in expenses than you had in revenue. You had growth on both sides, but the expenses did grow a little bit more than revenue. And you always got to keep in mind with this a little bit, as big as you are, it averages out a little more, but some shift in how many people you have contracted versus employed in some positions. Providers, sometimes nursing, might have more contracted people than other times. And that, you got to keep that in mind when you're looking at the FTE number. Any questions on any of those? The next up is just the last letter of just things you would want to know, and there's nothing negative in here. No changes in accounting policy. When we talked about the one you could have had to change to, the one that was bad, and then the least one coming up. And then estimates in the financial statements, the allowance for uncollectible accounts is always an estimate of financial statements. Medicare and Medicaid cost report settlements, the rural health clinic, Medicaid managed care. So they're not always going to come out exactly how they're estimated at the wrong time. And actually, you know, I didn't mention this earlier, but Medicaid, when I was talking about the third-party settlements, there's Medicaid is very, very, it's like tens of thousands, small numbers. It's because actually the only part of Medicaid that's cost settled is the traditional Medicaid. And so as you get more Medicaid managed care, as more of the patients switch to that, that's not cost settled. So actually the actual settlement on Medicaid is a much smaller number. But that little bit of population, which is I think is an interesting policy issue that the state needs to address, is now that 10 or 15% of the people that are still in traditional Medicaid, that drives the rate for the other 80-85%, which might not be an accurate one-to-one ratio anymore. In the old days, when the system started, it was more like 80-20, 80% traditional, 20, kind of making that number up. It was definitely more people on the traditional side, and that drove the rate for the managed care patients. Now it's the little group of people driving the rate for the big group of people. And some people would contend, that's what I think is a policy issue, is that labor delivery is the more expensive part of your services, and the people that are in receiving labor delivery services are more likely to be in the managed care part of Medicaid than the traditional part. And so that's the cost, the most expensive service is left out of the calculation. So I think the state has to address this soon, because you're getting down to a handful of people setting the rate for the rest. And I don't know if anybody's really tried to do the math to see how much it changes that.
Interesting.
Yeah. No difficulties in performing the audit. No material audit adjustments. No disagreements. There's a lot of other stuff up there.
Well, thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. This is a wonderful report. I can imagine the amount of work and commitment into having this happen. So, thank you.
We got you.
It takes a hospital, a village hospital, to do everything to pull it all together, but the people here in this room are the ones that are the major responsible ones, and thank you. Anybody have other comments?
Well, I just totally agree with you, but I do have a sort of a question, nothing to do with this audit. How many audits that you do you have problems with management administration?
Well, like, I won't call it problems with management. I have a finding, so.
No, or they're uncooperative, or they hide things.
Well, sometimes we have no findings if they're not cooperative. No, okay. That's part of the job. finding-wise, material weakness, significant deficiency, I should come up with a real number, but I feel like it's a roughly half the time that we report something. Sometimes in some years, I mean, a little more. I shouldn't think the ones I've done just in the last few weeks, because it's kind of the season of these. And it's at least half material weakness or significant deficiency reported. A lot of times it's a material audit adjustment. And oddly, some people can't reconcile cash, which blows my mind. Just give us a big old,
a shoebox with receipts.
Any other comments, questions?
Always good to see an audit without anything exciting.
Yeah.
Mundane audit.
Boring.
Bruce, do you have anything that you wanted to add or say?
Well, I think it's a great report, and I think, you know, great compliments to management, especially the financial group, on how they have done their job and, you know, keeping us in compliance and keeping track of everything going where it's supposed to go. It looks like we'll have to have Aaron with the cafeteria become our revenue generator for us.
Oh, he's got plans.
Yeah, I know.
I think the community would welcome that.
Yeah.
Okay, well then, there's no further business, and I will entertain a motion to conclude the meeting.
So moved.
Second.
All right, any discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.